From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
El Cerrito,
Union Square,
San Francisco,
South of Market,
from Albany,
Hayes Valley,
Rockbridge in Oakland.
I'm from the Civic Center. I live across the street.
Coming up, lifers in California are leaving prison in record numbers.
These convicted murderers back out in society are the least likely to return to prison for violating a parole condition or for committing another crime.
Then we'll find out how a prison arts program transforms lives.
Once you get those creativity juices to flowing, it's almost impossible to stop them.
And we'll learn about the art of making a book the old-fashioned way.
This is a bookbinder's tool that's made out of cow bone and has been used by bookbinders for probably over 300 years.
That's all coming up on Cross Currents. Since Jerry Brown became governor, a record number of inmates have been released from California prisons, including so-called lifers, those sentenced to life behind bars. There are two kinds of life sentences, either with or without the possibility of parole. Someone sentenced to life with the possibility of parole is expected to use the decades spent in prison to reform himself. And he has to go before a parole board to prove that's happened. But since 1988, the governor has had the option to veto a parole board decision. And they've done so in the majority of cases until now. As Nancy Mullane reports, Jerry Brown has upheld 82% of parole board decisions, freeing nearly 1,400 lifers in the past 3 years. And Nancy joins me now to explain.
We have elected a governor, Governor Jerry Brown, who has come to office with the interest of looking at the statistics, looking at the facts about what are we getting from our prison population. And if we look at the lifer population, individuals who have been convicted of a murder offense, first degree murder or second degree murder, we send them to prison. And 15 or 25 years later, they go before the parole board, to whose job it is to determine whether or not they are safe to release from parole. If they find them suitable, if they find someone who has been convicted of a murder suitable for parole, that they are no longer a threat to public safety, and we release them back into society, this population, these convicted murderers back out in society, are the least likely to return to prison for violating a parole condition or for committing another crime. So Jerry Brown is looking at these statistics and saying, rather than reverse the parole board's decisions, I'm going to allow those parole board decisions to stand.
And I think that that probably goes against common assumptions that murderers would be the least likely to reoffend. But can you – you said we've known this for a long time.
Well, we've known it since 1945. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation issues an annual report. And when I began looking at this population of individuals serving life sentences for murder in California prisons back in 2007, I pored over every annual report. And the very first report that the CDCR issued in 1945, they stated in their report, surprisingly, individuals convicted of a homicide who are released from prison have the lowest recidivism rate of any category of crime. So we've known this. But then in 1988, things changed.
So you're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan, and I'm speaking with Nancy Mullane. She's the executive producer of Life of the Law. She's also the author of Life After Murder, which follows five men who were convicted of murder and sentenced to life with the possibility of parole. So you say that we have known since 1945 that murderers released after the parole process are the least likely to reoffend on any counts. But so then why over the past, 30 years before Jerry Brown took office, had governors essentially reversed the parole board's decisions?
Well, in 1988, the voters in California had the opportunity to vote for a law. It was called Proposition 89. And it was the year of the Willie Horton. And I don't know if your listeners remember Willie Horton, but it was a presidential election year. There was a man named Willie Horton in Massachusetts who was serving a life without the possibility of parole. But in Massachusetts, they released their everyone had an opportunity to have in prison, had an opportunity to go home on a weekend furlough. This individual went was given a weekend furlough. While he was on the weekend furlough, he committed horrible crimes. So throughout the country, there was this Willie Horton kind of stigma that we have to hold every governor accountable for anyone released from prison. And in California, the voters had the opportunity to pass a law that said any individual convicted of a murder offense who is found suitable for parole, the governor now has the opportunity and authority to reverse that parole board decision. So before that, something like 250 individuals convicted of a murder one, murder two offense were released from California prisons every year. Beginning in 1988, that all changed. Now it was truly a political decision because we knew the parole board had been doing its job. People convicted of murder released from prison had the lowest recidivism rate, and yet we began giving our governor the authority to reverse, and the governors four governors have reversed between 75% and 99% of all paroles.
And that's because they considered it political suicide. There was no real incentive to not to reverse.
Well, think of it this way: if the governor allowed one to go home, and that one did something bad, violated a crime or
committed a terrible crime.
Right. But then it would be held on his responsibility. But one thing that we've also discovered over the last 21 years, there have been 1,000 released, even with governor reversals. Of those 1,000 released in 21 years, the recidivism rate was 1.5%, and not one committed another murder. So what we now know is it's true. If we do send someone to prison with a murder conviction and we ask them to change, that they do change. And when they do get out, they come back to society and they contribute to society rather than costing society keeping them in prison. So what Jerry Brown has done is he's come into office in 2011, January 2011, and he's allowing the parole board to do its job.
That's Nancy Mullane. She is the author of Life After Murder. She covers criminal justice issues, and she is the executive producer of Life of the Law. So I'm wondering, with this big shift in terms of how Governor Brown is approaching this issue, do you think that the politics of kind of get tough on crime, mass incarceration, are changing?
Well, I think it's time. You know, we as a society, we see ourselves as individuals, that we are a society of individuals. And yet when we've kind of built up this perception over the last 30 years of if we're tough on crime, then we're going to be safer. But what we've actually done is we've just incarcerated more people and held them in prisons for longer periods of time. And not only is it unjust because we now know that they can change and do change, and when they're given that opportunity, they make the most of that opportunity. But it's also breaking the bank. You know, we have a prison industry now in California at $11 billion a year. And when you think of all of the individuals that have had their paroles been found suitable for parole over the last 30 years, and at somewhere between $50,000 and $100,000 a year per person
to incarcerate
them in California, and then we've kept them in for another 5, 10, 20 years. This is costing the state of California an extraordinary amount of money, and I think we've all come to recognize that when we send someone to prison under the law, with a life with parole, that is exactly what we've given them, a life with parole. And Governor Brown, in his extreme wisdom and his experience, is making these truly courageous decisions because he is looking at the law and he is trusting his parole board.
Nancy Mullane covers criminal justice, is the author of Life After Murder, and the executive producer of the radio podcast Life of the Law. We'll put a link to all of that information at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. This is Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Once inmates are paroled, a big challenge is keeping them from reoffending. Arts programs in California prisons have helped. Arts in Correction was the state's main venue for prisoners to use writing, music, drama, and painting to express their feelings in a creative and safe way. Yet the state cut its funding for the program a few years ago. Now advocates are pushing to restore creative workshops like one called Brothers in Pen.
My shoulders brushed the sides of the wall and bunk. As I paced the 9 feet of my cell between the sink and door, a scream echoed silently from my tortured soul, as hopeless dreams of a once meaningful life floated endlessly across my mind.
That's San Quentin inmate Paul Stopher reading from a short story he wrote behind bars. Creative self-expression is a proven force for change in prisons. Inmates in this creative writing class and classes like it are 40% less likely to commit crimes when they're released.
Sitting on the stainless steel throne in the back of my cell, a single tear rolled slowly down my nose and fell to the floor. I whispered to God, "Now it is enough."
Arts and Corrections lost its state support in 2010. Today, only a third of all state prisons have some form of arts programming left, thanks to private funding and volunteer support. KLW's Kyungjin Lee visited the program at San Quentin, and she brings us this story.
Look who's reading tonight.
Butler.
Every Wednesday evening, around 20 students finish up chow and trickle into the fine arts classroom next door. They sign in and set chairs into a circle. The room looks like a regular art studio. Almost. The walls are filled with half-finished paintings, and band equipment is covered and tucked away. But the students wear prison-issued blue uniforms, and coiled barbed wire is clearly visible from the windows. Zoe Mullery has taught the creative writing class at San Quentin for 15 years. She loves how writing, and fiction in particular, allows her students to tap into experiences they haven't been able to explore.
People who have painful stories, people who have complicated, perhaps shameful stories. And we're gonna hear the end of Eric's piece. We missed the ending. We ran out of time last week, missed the ending.
The class can accommodate up to 3 readers per night. Mullery says there's a range of styles, including science fiction, children's stories, and memoirs.
Okay, so we'll try this again. This will be part two. You wouldn't believe what happened next. It was dark. Not just dark, but beyond dark.
The rest of the class falls silent, focused on Eric Curtis's words. Some stare down at the floor. Others have their eyes closed. He tells his story for about 20 minutes.
And things will be different, I promise. And the first thing we're going to do is find us a church.
Thank you. All right, let's have comments.
Most of Mullery's students are lifers, but she doesn't know the exact crimes they've committed. It's prison etiquette not to ask. Their writing tells her who they really are.
The majority of people who come to my class are people that I feel like, well, this person is really working on, you know, being a person of integrity, a person who could live a life in the world that would be a life of giving and not taking.
James Metters has been in prison for 16 years on a third strike conviction.
I received a sentence of 35 years of life for second-degree unarmed robbery.
Metter says his drug addiction led him to steal, but his last sentence was heavy enough to wake him up.
I know if I'm ever going to get out, I'm going to have, you know, good behavior. I'm going to have to change. And so for me, I made the decision to change.
Metters was transferred to San Quentin 2 years ago and joined the creative writing class as soon as he got here. He says it helped him get a leash on his temper.
You know, instead of lashing back, you know, with anger or not listening when somebody gives you some constructive criticism, you know, not listening to people when they're trying to tell you, you know, something right, when they're pointing out some of your flaws and some things that could actually make you a better person.
Studies have shown the benefits of arts programming on prisoner rehabilitation. Fewer disciplinary actions behind bars, a lower recidivism rate overall. One study, for instance, found that 2 years after release, nearly 70% of Arts and Corrections inmates were still out of prison, a 40% improvement over the general prison population. Mullery says being able to see characters in a story, how they relate to and impact each other, actually teaches empathy.
People who've committed crimes need to understand anything. It's how they've affected other people. I mean, I feel like that's what's lacking in a criminal act, is that you're not considering how that's affecting someone else. And I feel like that's exactly what happens when you learn to be a good writer. You have to consider how each character experiences that story.
But in times of tight budgets, providing creative outlets for inmates has proven to be a disposable item. In 2003, the state cut more than $160 million from prisons, including more than $3 million for arts programming. In 2010, legislators killed the arts program altogether. Now that the state has a budget surplus, advocates may have their way. Some legislators are working to restore a limited number of prison arts programs in the state's new budget. Jerry Elster says that would be very good news for people behind bars. He got out of San Quentin 6 years ago and now works as an organizer for All of Us or None, a prisoner advocacy group in San Francisco.
I went in for a second-degree murder out of Los Angeles County. I was gang-related, gang-involved, and I took the life of one of my gang rivals during a gang altercation.
Elster says it took him almost 10 years in prison to start wanting something better for himself. He began by pursuing spiritual teachings and eventually connected with Zoe Mullery's creative writing class.
Once you get that those creativity juices to flow in, it's almost impossible to stop them.
Elster says he could have sped up his rehabilitation if he joined the class sooner. The same goes for the friends he left behind.
How many guys in prison, right, actually believe they can rap, right? You know, how many guys actually believe they really have something to say? You're going to be looking at the high 90-something percentile, right? If they had more room to go to a creative writing class, man, I'm going to teach you how to, where you can really learn how to do your rap. Not only learn how to do your rap, express yourself, be able open to express yourself in any way you feel you can do it in a positive way. I know they'll be into it.
Legislators say the final arts rehab budget will shake out this summer, which means even if they do, the programs might not get reinstated until next year. In San Quentin, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
Do you think some of our state's budget surplus should go to funding prison arts programs? Let us know what you think at our tip line. It's 415-264-7106. Just leave us a message at 415-264-7106 and we'll try to put your perspective on the air. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. As we heard in that last piece, literature, poetry, prose, the spoken word can play a fundamental role in people's lives. It's a way to understand our inner selves and to better connect with the world we live in. Our next story comes from Litography, a new multimedia storytelling project that aims to map San Francisco's literary past, present, and future. We're teaming up with Litography as it launches a Kickstarter campaign today to commission stories from all kinds of Bay Area creatives. Stories that will air right here on Cross Currents. For our first installment, we're going to take a look inside what's behind many great stories, the actual physical book. Nowadays, most books are quickly put together or bound in large factories. Reams of paper whir through mechanized assembly lines, and huge blades slice thick piles of pages, shooting out bestsellers in minutes. But there are still a few bookbinders who do it the old-fashioned way. They use tools with names like bone folders, job backers, and guillotines, along with sewing machines, glue, and paper, to make new books and to restore old ones. San Francisco used to be a hub for the craft. Before the 1906 earthquake, there were over 30 traditional bookbinderies in the Bay Area. Today, only a few remain. KALW's Angela Johnston takes us to a workshop in the Mission, where a bookbinder is keeping a centuries-old tradition alive.
Stepping inside the tourist bookbindery is kind of like stepping back in time. The wide open space is packed full of retro machines from the 1920s that could double as torture devices. Electric paper cutters with long blades, sizzling hot rusty knives, and a set of 8-foot-tall cast iron weights. Rolls of cloth and leather line the walls, and their earthy smells mix with odors of oil, paper, and hot glue.
A modern bookbindery would have equipment that looks a little bit more like supercomputers.
That's Tim James. He's the bookbinder here.
The equipment would move blindingly fast, and a book would be created. You'd have paper going in one end and books coming out at the other end without ever having been touched by a human.
That's not how it works at Taurus, though. Here, it's all about the human touch. James makes custom edition, fine-bound books using tools and methods that have been passed down for generations. He does everything from restoring tattered children's books to making cocktail menus for small restaurants to binding special editions of limited-run books. That's what he's making today.
We are going to make a fine press book from start to finish.
The book he's making isn't necessarily the type of book you're going to find slumped on the shelves of a used library book sale. It's a big hardcover edition of an encyclopedia of falconry, a modern update to a book first published by a British naturalist in 1891. It has over 500 pages of illustrations and articles about these birds of prey. This edition is going to be leather-bound with goat skin and embossed with gold lettering. And James is going to make every single copy of this book one at a time.
This is a National sewing machine. It's a Smythe-style sewing machine. All properly sewn, machine-sewn books are referred to as Smythe-sewn.
It looks like a giant weaving loom with 5 large spools of thread at the top attached to 8 hooks and needles inside. First, James has to sew all these pages together, and he has to make sure not to get them out of order. So he groups the thick pieces of paper into what are called signatures.
A signature is a grouping of typically 16 pages, 4 sheets of paper, not unlike the first section of a newspaper. Then we'll bring the text block over to the sewing machine, and I will hand feed each individual signature into the machine. You're lucky because she's really singing for you today.
While James works the machine, he looks like a musician playing an organ. His hands hold the pages on a horizontal bar called a saddle, and he uses his feet to work a pedal on the floor.
When I put the signature on a saddle, it moves into the machine, and 8 punches come up from underneath and poke holes in the signature, and 8 needles come down from the top, and that's sewn.
What comes out is a neat stack, about 500 pages thick, all stitched together on one side with thread. But it's not perfect. Some pages are sticking out. So the next step is taking the sewn pages, called a text block, to the guillotine. Yes, the guillotine.
As the name implies, there's a large knife that comes down from above and cuts whatever it is below it. In this case, we're going to try to restrict ourselves to the book.
James does this 3 times for all 3 sides. What was once just a stack of paper is now starting to look more like a book. And the next step makes it even more recognizable.
Then I'll bring the text block, rounded text block, over to what we call a job backer.
The job backer works like a big vice grip for books. James clamps the book together and uses a metal hammer to pound on the sharp sides of the spine. This slightly curves the spine, and gives it an edge.
And that allows sort of a place for the cover to rest, and it keeps the book from sagging in its case after years.
But the true strength of a book, James tells me, comes from the cover and a lot of glue.
I just cut the front cover and the back cover out of what looks like chipboard. But it's actually a very dense, special material called bookboard.
After that, James covers the board with a piece of dark brown goatskin leather.
From there, we will cut the leather for the spine and carefully edge pair it so that it's thin and doesn't cause a ridge underneath the cloth.
The next step is the title. For that, James uses gold foil. It looks like saran wrap, but it's a lot more expensive.
A 200-foot roll of gold foil, 4 inches wide, would be about $250.
He lays out a sheet of the precious foil on top of the book. Next, he spells out the title of the book, letter by letter, in metal type, and loads that into the lid of what looks like an industrial dry cleaner shirt press. And it's hot like one, too. Before James presses it onto the book's cover, it has to be heated to 220 degrees. The words Bibliotheca Accipitraria are embossed in the leather cover. It's beautiful, but he's still not done.
This is a tool, bookbinder's tool, that's made out of cow bone.
It's called a bone folder.
And has been used by bookbinders for probably over 300 years. Maybe longer.
The one James is using is a gift from the bookbinder who taught him his trade. It looks like a tongue depressor, shiny and smooth, molded to the shape of his palm. He's using it to fold the leather and the cloth over the cover board, a final step before gluing everything together. The last thing to do is to put the sewn block of papers inside the cover and let the book sit for a day or two under heavy weights.
Well, my favorite part of being a commercial bookbinder is seeing the big, tall, 8-foot-high book presses completely full of books.
James says most people just assume books are cranked out by machines.
So they don't have any real feeling for the object unless it's given to them by somebody that's important. I think with all handmade objects, you're making them just a little bit better than they could be made by hand. And there's an appreciation that people have when you finish it, that they know the person that made it for them. And that tends to be lost when you have machinery involved in too many of the processes.
After 24 hours in the press, the newly minted Bibliotheca Accipitraria is finished. Plate 3, Falconry for You. Plate 13, An Approved Treatise of Hawks and Hawking. Plate 18, The Gentleman's Recreations. Plate 47, Aristocrats of the Air. In about an hour, James has made one book. He'll make a few hundred more of these over the next week or so, in between other orders to bind restaurant menus or a PhD thesis. He'll ship the books back to the author, who will sell them for $150 on falconry websites or in specialty stores. Now, the Bibliotheca Accipitraria might not make Amazon's bestseller list or jump off the shelves at Barnes & Noble, but James is proud to have put a little bit of himself into each page. In San Francisco, I'm Angela Johnston for Cross Currents.
Want to see a job backer in action? Wondering just how that guillotine works? We've got great bookbinding photos at our website. That's also where you can find a link to more information about lithography. Go to kalw.org and click on Cross Currents.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Holly Kernan, and now it's time for another installment of Segment X, extras from the KALW News team. This is where our staff members pull back the curtain on radio production to share something extra, interesting, or delightful with you. Ever wondered what happens after an author's masterpiece gets stitched together and embossed with gold foil? Well, here at Cross Currents, we have a little insight into that. Here's KALW's Ashley Ann Krigbaum to tell you more.
Each week, KALW receives a stack of books from publishers and authors who hope will feature their newest creation on the air. Over the years, we've accumulated quite a library. We wanted to share some of the more unique titles to come through. Among them, could there be The Next Ulysses or Pride and Prejudice? We'll let you decide.
So first I have here, Vampires Are Us.
All right, we got Game World.
This one is called Herding Donkeys.
The Trolley Problem, or Would You Throw the Fat Guy Off the Bridge?
Parnuclean for Chocolate.
Reduced to Joy.
What else do we have here?
50 Dates in 50 States.
My Unrelenting Darkness.
Outing the Oligarchy.
The Weirdness. You know what? I should be reading all of the colons in this in these books. All books have colons. The Weirdness, a novel.
Rise of the Warrior Cop.
One woman's journey to positive change.
This one is called No Boxing Allowed.
Apparently there's a book called Real Vampires Have Curves.
Book one, A Journey of a Thousand Seasons.
You can find previous editions of Segment X and subscribe to our podcast at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. That's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Audrey Dilling, Jen Chien, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Nina Gensler-Debs, Liz Mack, Daphne Matsyaraki, Mary Reese, Chris Hoff, Charlotte Silver, Stephen Short, and Rachel Wong. Today's show was produced by Julie Kane and engineered by Seth Samuel. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Ben Trefney is our executive editor. And thanks to your generosity, we can proudly say that we are listener-supported, organic, independent, local public radio. The Gravel Spreaders, who you're hearing now, claim to be from the Deep South, south of Market Street in San Francisco, that is. You can experience the metal grass sound of the Gravel Spreaders on Friday when they play Smiley's Saloon in Bolinas. Music should start about 9 p.m. All of that information, along with more local music and more local stories, is at KALW.org. Just click on Cross Currents. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.
Pretend she's overboard and self-assured. Oh no, I know a dirty word. Hello, 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 hello. Howdy, 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 how do? Howdy, 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 how do?